Hey y'all, A.B. Walker here, producer of the Humans of DevOps podcast and community manager at DevOps Institute. The Humans of DevOps podcast is still on summer holiday. Join us for new episodes beginning September 14th. On this week's Best Of episode, Jason Baum is joined by Ramon Medrano Lamas, site reliability engineer at Google. Enjoy.
You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
Hey everyone, it's Jason Baum, Director of Membership at DevOps Institute, and this is the Humans of DevOps podcast. So I am so excited today to be chatting with Ramon Medrano Lamas, site reliability engineer at Google in Zurich. He's leading the identity team there and responsible for authentication and identity management services at Google, concentrates on reliability aspects of new Google products and new features of existing products, and ensuring that they meet the high bar of a Google service. And Google did not provide me with that. I was able to come up with that all by myself. Ramon, <Yes. laughs> thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks to you for having me.
So
that was
a nice
introduction.
Oh yeah, I want a side job of just introducing people. That's all. I'm going to just follow you around into rooms and announce you that way, kind of like on The Crown. So Ramon, thank you so much for being on. I'm really excited to talk to you. Obviously, your experience over at Google and your career, but also today, we want to get to know you, Ramon, the individual, and kind of what led you to where you're at in your career. So if you're ready, let's get human.
Let's do it.
All right. So Ramon, tell us a little bit about your backstory, your career history. How did you end up where you are today at Google?
So if we do it like backwards, I've been at Google for 7.5 years, but I have been at Google at the same team for all this time, which is not many people do that. So I started as an intern in 2011. I was doing field technician, it was called. It's like some sort of SRE-like work, because you are going to be fixing and improving the laptops and the workstations and all the computers that are in the office, right? So it's for the developers and the engineers and so on. So I remember that time we were working with the Wi-Fi and all these certificates you have to put together to or install correctly in your Mac OS or Linux or whatever to make it work, right? Then I joined as an IC, the identity team, right? And we were working at the time we had only three services when I joined, right? We had the front end, a back end, and a storage server. That was it, right? And we were working on like capacity planning and so on, because the thing was working, was growing very fast at the time, right? Then I became the TL of the team, right? In, I don't know when, but after some point. And now I'm the manager of all these teams, right? And then we go back, this is in Zurich, right? Prior to that, I was in Geneva. I worked at CERN in the physics lab, where we had the accelerator there, which is a very nice place to be. I remember that I was working in one of the detectors in Atlas. And it's very nice because my work, I was doing infrastructure for computers, but I would go down to the detector every other day, right? And I was, there is the detector, which is a ring, like the accelerator, which is a ring of like 40 something kilometers, right? And there are the detectors and so on, but there is a small data center there, 100 meters under the surface, right? And you could bike through the tunnel, which is pretty cool. And prior to that, that was my first job, right? I was doing university in Spain, in Oviedo. It's a small town in the north, in the Cantabric Sea, right? So it's not the sunny part of Spain. It rains quite a lot, but it has good weather. And there, I studied a degree, like a bachelor and a master's there. It was focused in systems.
So you always knew that this was the career path for you. You kind of came out, it sounds like, and you pretty much went straight for it. And then really you've been at Google for quite a long time. So back before you went to university and everything, while you were in Spain, because I don't know if we covered, I know you went to university in Spain, but you are from Spain. You don't sound like you're from Zurich.
No.
How long have you been in Zurich?
So I've been in Zurich since 2013, so like close to 8 years, right? But in Switzerland, this is our 11th year.
Okay. Does everyone get a watch when you get to Google? Is that like you get a nice Zurich? No.
No, we get like a hat, like a funny hat with this like propeller thing that I used only once. But it's
Okay.
funny, like my kids have it now.
Yeah, there you go. I got a Google water bottle. I guess I could be on the team. So before you get to university, growing up as a child, were you into computers? How did that fascination happen?
So I got my first computer. My uncle gave me. It was a HP Vectra with a 386 and 4 megabytes of RAM, right? And that was when we started playing with that all the time, right? At the beginning was when games and all that stuff, and then you start doing like, hey, you can program this thing. What I mean, like you can do like fun stuff, right? With Pascal and all that things, right? And then. It was I was a computer like a hobby for a very long time since this was in 1995, so since like I don't know, I was like 9 years old, right? And I didn't know that at the time that I was gonna be working with computers like professionally, right? For me it was a hobby, like it was very nice to play games, program some stuff, right? But I was more into like math or physics, right? When I was in the at school than actually technology. We did not have a technology course though. Like in my school, there were other schools at the time that they were offering already programming lessons, right? Which was pretty advanced for the time,
I
right?
was going to say
We,
that's pretty early. I think we
yeah.
had Oregon Trail in my school. I think that was, and we had like four Macs, the old school Apple, the little turtle.
Yeah, but we didn't have that, right? So I was making the call in when I was about to start in university in 2004, right? And it was like, what should I do? Like classic engineering, like I don't know, industrial engineering that was is pretty popular in our region, right? Or do computers, right? I was there was this belief at the time that well, like if you do computer engineering, that's too easy, right? Because you have to do like the hard stuff that is the
Really?
actual real engineering, right? And I chose computers just because it was like I thought it was gonna be more, I don't know, everyone was gonna use a computer was the thing at the time, right?
What's
And that
real
was
engineering as opposed to what's the harder engineering? Is that like building spaceships? Like what is the harder engineering?
I don't know, these people is they do like build machines, right? And they do boats and race cars and all that stuff. So that's like actual tangible engineering that you can get a thing that you can touch at the end of the process, right? In computer, what we do is like, well, you have the programs. Well, that was the understanding at the time. I think that has changed quite a lot since then, right? And I think it was a really good call, right? Just to be quite honest. I think our industry is really nice. It's growing pretty fast. And I like it very much. I don't think I would like make machines.
Well, I mean, I often look back and I'm like, man, I really wish that we knew about computer programming in the way that it is now as like a profession. Because like you said, I don't think people really looked at it as much of a profession. We're about the same age, roughly. And I don't think that people really looked at coding the way they do now as like a real future profession. It was certainly on the edge, but it wasn't to the extent that it is now. And I look at it for someone like my daughter, and I'm like, oh man, we are so giving her computer coding lessons. And I know there's going to be something else, obviously, by the time she hits the workforce, but I feel like everybody needs to have kind of an understanding of it these days.
Yeah, I agree with that. So in my time, the we didn't. So I joined one of the first years of like actually computing engineering. Before that was math. It was on a specialization of the math grade. It was like do algorithms, right?
Okay. And did you ever have any interest? I mean, what I'm finding is on each one of these podcasts is a degree of learning about people. You know, either sometimes people take an interest in psychology often and why people do what they do, or some type of philosophy even, and apply it towards the computer science. And that's where kind of DevOps lives, in this nice little cushion of the meeting of human mind and computer mind. And I don't know if that was ever an interest for you, if that's something that you also were interested in.
No, so not at the beginning, right? This has developed like recently, right? At the beginning, it was all like, well, there are computers and I do program them and they do what I tell them to do, right? And that was I chose the system. So we had two like paths. There was one for management and more like what you comment of like project management or team management and the like the business side of things, right? And I went through the other. There was a pure systems stuff. So I never got into the psychology of things until I was put in the role of actually caring for a team, right? And that's when I discovered that was actually a useful thing to do.
Yeah, and I would imagine that, you know, since it is a relatively newer field, DevOps, with the terminology anyway, DevOps, that maybe, and I'm kind of guessing here, and I know nothing about it, like I am not a technical person in any way, but as a consumer of everything that is produced by these companies, and especially of Google, you know, if I say, okay, Google, it's going to tell me, you know, I can pretty much do anything I want. I could turn on a light, I can close a door, I can lock a door, I could turn on my thermostat, I could play music, which is pretty crazy. So the expectations now of the end user are probably so unbelievably high. It must tax you guys behind the scenes as to A, what's next, and B, how do we hold it all together?
Yeah, so I think the expectations are high. So they have always been high for example, for reliability, right? And I always say that the biggest success we have had in reliability is like when your internet connection goes down, the first thing you do is you ping google.com, right? Mm-hmm. And that means that people trust the infrastructure to be working, right? But now it's not only a consumer problem, right? It's not that the consumers are expecting their Google enabled machine to work. It's like if you think about the cloud, right? There are banks running their infrastructure in a cloud platform. There is hospitals running their, I don't know what infrastructure they have, into cloud platforms. There are even the, I don't know, cars these days. They have an automotive cloud and all that stuff, right? So it's not that it's high, it's that now it's in just about everything that moves, right?
Yeah, the cloud has kind of like become the new infrastructure of the world, right? It's kind of like when you're laying out roads for cars, or what we're going to be doing for electric vehicles, putting in the charging stations. I feel like that's kind of like what's happening behind the scenes with the cloud. It's kind of just become these little stations throughout the world. And I am so dumbing this down because that's my level of understanding, but I would imagine for Google, you guys must have one of the largest infrastructure for that on the planet.
So for cloud itself, I don't know how it compares because I don't work directly there, but I think the whole Google network and so on is, if not one of the biggest, right? Because if you think about the products and everything that is running in there, it's just humongous. Like when I moved from CERN to Google, right? CERN is pretty big because you have the accelerator that is producing like a shitloads of data, right? And you have a data center just in the detector, but then there's like tiers of them, right? There is one in Geneva, but then there is a distributed infrastructure around the world, right, to process all that data, right? But then I thought that was huge, right? And it's big, right? But then when you enter into the actual cloud of Google or AWS or all these big companies, that's a completely different scale. It's just astounding.
So let's back up to you. Let's talk more about you. You know, coming into it, you obviously said like this is something you knew sort of you wanted to do. You didn't really know what it was yet, but then as soon as computers started to evolve and you understood more, you knew this was the path for yourself. Were there any roadblocks? Was there any time in your life during this process that you're like, I don't know if this is for me?
At the beginning of university, it was not easy, right? Because you are dropped into, like, I didn't have any computing background besides my hobby, right? When I drop into the university, right? And the first thing you get is like algebra and calculus, and it's like, is this? I mean, this is hard, but is this going to be useful for anything, or this is just a filter that they have to just take people out, right? And the other one is programming, like programming. In a non-hobby way is completely different than when you just have your Raspberry Pi and you want to pull out something, right? Actually knowing algorithms and knowing how to use them and debugging bigger programs, right? That's not easy to learn, right? And that was, I mean, the learning curve was really steep at the beginning, right? So.
Yeah, the algebra and calculus, you just said, like, those are like bad words to me. Like, I'm a communications major in English. I no, thank you. Math is my right. You have the two brains. I am definitely not a math person. So I'd imagine for anybody though, once you start getting into complex problem solving, because that's really all it is, right? At the end of the day, we're talking complex problem solving. I can imagine it could be overwhelming. So you got past it. Did you have a mentor in the industry? How did you kind of take that next step?
So it was the first year we have a couple of professors that they were in there. They were close to the so we have a small it was a small school, right? So the professors could know each of the students, right? And they helped me learning programming and doing extra exercises and so on to actually like get this moment that everything clicks and you say like I know how this works now, right? Which I'm super thankful for. I think they're my personal heroes, these people. And and then after that, it was much I would not gonna say easier, but it was much more interesting for me at the time, because I got into the systems part. So we got like operating systems classes and so on. And then it's when I discovered I'm a systems dude. I'm sorry, I'm not gonna do machine learning. I'm gonna do operating systems. This is what is for me. And it was very nice because you just pull from that thread and there is quite a lot of things to learn, right?
So now you're in the industry. You've been at Google for a long time. What is it about Google that you like?
So few things. So I think at the beginning when you joined, you like other things that you like after you are a few years there. So at the beginning it was like holy shit, this is just humongous, like everything is so fancy, everything works perfect, right? And then over the years, one thing that I think is the best part of working at Google is the amount of autonomy you have to do whatever you want to do, right? And I'm not meaning it as you have the freedom to be tinkering with things that they are not useful for the business. I'm not meaning that. I'm meaning that if you are an IC and want to become a manager, there's a path for you and there's support for you to grow into that. If you want to, I don't know, change from SRE to working research, right? There is a path for you, right? So they really want you to grow and to actually pursue what you want, right? And if you align that with the company interest, right? I think it just works nicely.
Yeah, I think a lot of companies are probably learning that right now, with retention of talent. Because like you said, at the end of the day, what everybody wants is for themselves to grow, and that's the best thing for the company is for you to grow, right? And we keep hearing that term upskilling. Obviously, that's something we do through DevOps Institute, and we have certifications and all that. And we obviously encourage the companies to get their employees upskilled, because with today's workforce being virtual for, the past 13 months, you can come in and work anywhere. It doesn't matter where you are in the world, and you can be plugged in and you can work. We've proved that. That's been proven. So I would imagine it's getting more competitive out there. So it makes sense for a company like Google. We've heard it about Apple just being ahead of the game with their talent and trying to retain their talent.
Yeah, and it's key for innovation, right? Because then if you look how innovations that Google has done is people that is thinking out of the expected box that they have. So if I were to be, so if we only hire like DevOps people with for SRE, right, you would get like a very simple, very single kind of mindset, right? But if we start hiring like, I don't know, research scientists, right, and think for how you would run production and so on, then you'll say you would be able to apply new things that you would never did before, right? And that actually changes the game from time to time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, we don't all have to be pigeonholed into one thing. We're all human and probably bring different traits to the game. And a good company recognizes what traits you bring and can apply them, or even ask you to think about it and apply them. So we briefly talked about pandemic. Actually, before we talk about pandemic, I want to get into your background as far as where you've been living. I know we talked about Switzerland. Prior to that, did you move around much? You said you're from this small town in the north of Spain. What was that, a culture shock when you went to Switzerland, I would imagine?
It is quite different, yes. So, for example, one thing that I was realizing is that in Switzerland, they speak quite not as loud as in Spain. So that was the first thing, like just landing in the airport, right?
They're all whispering? How do they speak in Switzerland?
Not whispering, but it's not as noisy. Like, for example, the bus or whatever place that is full of people is not as noisy as in Spain. It might sound like a stupid thing to realize, but that's the first thing I got when I landed there. It's like things are quiet.
Oh, man, I'm from Manhattan. We scream.
Which is good and bad. Like, you need to like it, right? Other thing besides the language, there is the timing, like the schedules are slightly different, right? But one thing that is, I think it's nice is the how predictable things are here, right? So for example, you know that if someone commits to do something, it's gonna happen, right? And I think that makes things actually, especially for work, right? Makes things quite easier.
And how about the weather? I'd spent a month in Spain. Beautiful, beautiful weather, mostly in central, some South Spain, mostly central and the coast. But how's the weather difference been in Switzerland?
So it's continental, so the summers are not that hot. We have a few, like 1 or 2 weeks that it's really hot, but that's about it. And then the spring, I do not like it because I'm allergic. Like I have like this allergy to plants and so on, right? So here there is really, it rains in spring, so you are screwed in spring, right? But you have the winter, right? So there's snow and we are like an hour from the Alps, right? And that's very nice because you just take the train and are in the slopes in like an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And I like that.
Yeah. So are you more, so you like the colder weather then?
Yeah, yeah. I was a summer person, but after moving here, I definitely prefer the winter.
I can see if you've never really experienced much winter, you would like it. Give it a few years. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see. Do you ski then?
I do snowboard, yes. I tried the skiing and there are just too many moving parts in there, so I just can't do it.
Hard to stay up. Yeah, well, that's good. So back to the pandemic, okay, going from one to the other. So, we mentioned, talent and retaining talent. How has Google been working through the pandemic? What do you see that's changed that maybe you'll keep doing? Here in the States, it's getting better. There's hope on the horizon. I have no idea. I know the European Union is a little bit behind, except for UK. But how is it going over there with the pandemic, and is there hope on the horizon?
Yeah, so there is like, I think Europe goes like around 3 weeks behind in the schedule of delivering the vaccine. So the thing is ramping up quite exponentially nice now. So I hope that by the end of summer, we all be like, not back to complete normal, but in a better shape than we are now, right? So I think the pandemic has been, so I can tell you for me and my team, right, for the whole company there, I think the only thing I can tell you is my opinion, that I think they have done it well in a few things. Like, for example, they closed the office early to like be safe and so on, right? So I think in hindsight, those were good calls, right? And now for returning to the office, they are taking like the measures that they need and so on, right? For me and my team, so one thing that the pandemic has changed, so at the beginning it was a mess, right? The first 3 weeks for us, we were a team that was designed to be together in the office, right? That all the culture and the processes and everything was around, like we are expected to be there, right? The first week, it was okay, because like, okay, we're going from home, but this is going to be like a week or two, right?
Famous. It was 2 weeks to flatten the curve.
Yes, and then there we are 13 months after, right? Yeah. But so we did like some kind of incident management style coordination of saying like, okay, like we are going to be like for a few weeks at home, right? We need to figure out basic stuff like access to production, like can we debug a service if we are paged from home? Like do we have what we need? We came up with things that they were silly at the time, but they proved to be useful. That was like half of my team had the same ISP at home, right? So an outage of this ISP would have not allowed the team to operate and things like that, right? That was in the first week. Then there was a time from week two to like, I don't know, a couple of months, that it was a complete mess, at least personally for me, because I have the kids, they close the schools. It was my wife had to work from home too. So two kids and two people trying to work from home is just didn't work out. Right? But then we managed to get a nice, so Google is very flexible with the schedule of working. So I work in the like a New York kind of style. So I start working after lunch and work until like 9 or 10 p.m. which is nice because my wife works in the other half of the day. And for me, it's nice because I can meet with California. I have more time to have meetings with them, right? So that's working out pretty well now. I think it's personally has improved quite a lot our like well-being, right? For the team, so I think we are still navigating the transition from being a non-remote team to be a remote team, right? And you can read articles in the internet and so on, how you do it and so on, but until you have to do it, you don't know how difficult that is. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different paradigm, I would say.
Yeah, I think that now that's been so long, we're definitely getting more used to it, getting better at it, just in time to possibly go back. So then I think the next question is, what is that future? Is it going to be hybrid? Is it going to, because I think people got really used to working from home. They got good at working from home. Production is up in a lot of places. You know, I'm someone who works better from home. I never thought I would be, but I am. You know, what happens next?
So I don't know. So I think the company is still putting together the plans for the future of work, as they call it, right? And I think, so one thing that we have all realized is that things are not going to be as they used to be. So we are not going to be back to December 2019, right? Mm-hmm. Because of different reasons. I think, as you say, a remote work has proven to be something that works, right? So I think, for example, some people, they actually work better from home than in an office, right? And I think and this is my opinion, Robert, I think we should respect that, because this is talent that you can retain and they can work in that way, right? Will the office be back? I think the office will be back. I think there is, at least for us, we are a team that used to be working in the office, right? So I think in some way or another, we'll be back. Will be hybrid, remote or not, that I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think anyone knows yet, but it seems like the majority of people want some type of hybrid. That whenever I've seen the polls come out, it's like 70% or 60% want hybrid. So I think that we're probably on the way there. Who knows what everyone's going to do, but it just seems to make sense. And plus, I think right now everyone's just itching to be somewhere. They want to be around people. They want a bit of their normalcy, but maybe taking it to the nth degree, just because we've all been, you know, kind of hibernating for the past 13 months or so. So it'll be interesting to see when we get back to the quote unquote normal. Yeah. All right. So moving on from pandemic. Now this is the part of the podcast where we can go anywhere we want with learning about you. And sometimes I take it to music. Sometimes I take it to art or books or whatever you're up to. But before I ask you about that, I'm going to put you on the spot, kind of. What's one unique thing about you that nobody knows?
I don't know. I do fencing. Not many people know that. So I, when we moved to Switzerland, my wife has been doing fencing since she was a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you should try it out, right? And he's like, okay, I'm not the sports kind of person, right? So he's like, okay, I'll try it out. And it was very nice. it was really, really cool. So we do it since then.
So do you fence your wife?
Yeah.
That can't be healthy. What if you? So when you win, is that like cool or?
It's cool. She wins all the time. So
okay, there you go. That sounds like a better dynamic, I would think. Better for longevity.
Way more experience. Yeah, she has been fencing for a really long time, I can win from time to time, but it's not frequent. But it's I think it's a very nice sport. We only do it. We don't do it at home, right? Because mm-hmm. you need to have space to do it. But it's nice. I really enjoy it. And not many people know that I do that, actually.
So you haven't fenced before, but your wife, you said, had been fencing since what? Since high school or?
Yeah, earlier. She was a kid when she started. I don't know, 10 years old or something, maybe.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I was with a wooden sword, but I wouldn't call it fencing. It was more just kind of hitting.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that at the beginning. It's okay, you hit the other, right?
Yeah.
It's it's much more subtle than that.
Sure.
And it's for fencing, with this small épée in French. So it's a small sword, I guess, in a thin sword, sorry. It's more the speed of your arm than any strength. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, it failed miserably at that.
You have to, I would imagine, have really good eye-hand coordination. So that's where I think I would fail. Mm-hmm. I don't think I would block anything. Well, that's cool. So, all right. So during the pandemic, I know for myself, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, I went to music. Music has always been my backbone. It's always been my thing that's kept me sane. What's your thing that's been keeping you sane throughout the pandemic other than fencing?
So we got one thing that was interesting for us, for traveling. We used to travel, not quite a lot, but a few times a year. And with the kids, with the pandemic measures, it's impossible to get into a plane or into a train, right? So we got a camper van, one of these California from Volkswagen, right? And man, that's a nice way to travel with kids. It's really nice because we don't have a schedule, so there is no, you need to take the train at our food, right? So we get into the van, we move around, right? We can't cross the border, but there is still enough Switzerland to go through. And that has helped a lot, especially when the kids were in the summer holidays, that there was no school or whatever. So every weekend we would just take it and spend sleep in the thing, spend the weekend and come back. And that has been very nice because the first lockdown in April was really horrible.
Yeah, I would imagine that RV sales must have been really good this past year because I've heard so many people talking about doing the same type of thing. We were talking about it actually, about doing some type of RV trip, and it's not the kind of vacation we would have normally done before. We're definitely, like you said, we hop on a plane, we go somewhere. So that's, I would imagine sales must be really high for RVs right now.
Yeah, so we went contacting the dealership, we want this one new, and it's so it's April, it's March, sorry, you will have it by November. And he's like, wait, what are you doing with it? How many manufacturers a year? It's demand was really high. So we got the one that was secondhand. It was the best deal we can make because we are enjoying it for the whole summer.
Awesome. Well, I hope you enjoy it this summer. So Ramon, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It was really great getting to know you.
Thank you for having me. It was a very nice conversation.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm going to end this podcast the same as I always do, encouraging you to become a premium member of the DevOps Institute. You get access to even more great resources just like this one. And until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and most of all, stay human. Live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.